You're listening to a Towson University podcast.
Welcome to On the Mark, where we have candid conversations about meaningful and consequential work happening here at Towson University. I'm Mark Ginsburg. It's my honor to serve as president of Towson University, located, of course, in Towson, Maryland. And on this podcast, we're introducing you to members of our university community who are engaged in high-impact teaching, research, and student success practices. Today, I'm joined by two special guests, first by Nathan Wilder and also by Mary Nadelin, two leaders in our sports medicine arena here at Towson University. Nathan is our senior athletic director for sports medicine and performance, serving as our head athletic trainer for TU's 19 Division I varsity intercollegiate athletic teams. He has more than 30 years of professional training experience, athletic training experience, that is, ranging from high school athletics to the NFL. Mary Nadelin is a clinical associate professor in TU's Department of Kinesiology, specializing in athletic training education. In addition to being an educator, she also has worked as a professional athletic trainer, including working in collegiate sports, as well as being a trainer for the U.S. national lacrosse teams. Nathan and Mary, thank you for being here and welcome. Great to have you here. And maybe we can start off with kind of a general question to just tell us a little bit about what the roles of athletic training, athletic trainers are, and some of the important settings that athletic trainings are working in today.
Well, athletic training as a profession is an allied healthcare profession. And what is really important for folks to know is that we are responsible for the healthcare of the athletes. And athletes can come in many different forms. Youth athletes, athletes that may be in the rodeo circuit with Justin Sports Medicine, athletes that you think of traditionally on the sidelines, playing collegiate sports, playing youth sports, rec sports. Also, then it can be in the athlete who is a firefighter or a first responder. There are many, many different forms of an athlete or a person who is athletic. That is our role as an athletic trainer, is to really care for those individuals, to assess and prevent injuries from happening. So we have many, many roles as an athletic trainer.
In athletic training, the program has shifted. For one time, my understanding, it was a bachelor's level program, and it's transitioned in recent years to become a graduate program. So your students are coming in with degrees in exercise science or the health sciences and then taking advanced training in sports medicine.
Yes, you're absolutely correct.
And I was going to say that even though maybe a lot of people who have been involved in sport might gravitate this way, but I think we're seeing with this master's level program that there's people who might have zero background in sport and they're just really interested in physical medicine and the specialization of working with somewhat, I would say, even maybe injured, but healthy populations. The physically active professions, physically active individuals are who we specialize in dealing with versus maybe a healthcare profession that deals with more comorbidity or, disabled type populations. So I don't think having a sports background is necessary at all to be in this field, but it does tend to be one of the common factors that people get into it for.
Well, and in fact, it seems like athletic trainers are working in all kinds of settings today, not just with athletic teams, but in orthopedic practices and rehabilitation settings and other places. So that's pretty common.
That is becoming more and more common. I think traditionally you will see sidelines and us working with athletes. But yes, there are settings where athletic trainers are branching out to help those physically active people prevent injuries and then we certainly, a very good skill set of ours is to be able to return them to their functioning activity.
I've learned that there are about 59,000 certified athletic trainers in the country, about 59,000. About 42% of those work at colleges and universities, but a growing number are working at the secondary level or at the primary school level, working with athletes who are below the collegiate level.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and there is an absolute need for that. And there is a really large push to make sure that high schools have athletic trainers there to care for those individuals.
Right.
I was going to say on that note, it's really interesting because, what we know of kind of the profession from its early days is that a lot of the higher end or the professional teams might have been the first people to have of sport. But when we talk about, prevention of injury, it's almost like you got to flip it upside down. It's almost like you wish you would provide all your resources at the lower level so we could protectively build these individuals up and maybe not be so injured when they get to college or professional level. But, it seems like the secondary school area in all states is different. And I know there's a huge push to put, you know, athletic trainers in every high school and to find ways to have a healthcare system amongst, you know, the youth for sure.
So picking up on two issues you mentioned, one is collaboration. I know that USATs collaborate with other health professionals, both in the physical health space as well as the behavioral health space, with your student athletes. Talk a little bit about those collaborative relationships that ATs have.
Yeah, so at Towson, I mean, internally we have a few. Dietitian is one. Mental health counselor is another. Orthopedic surgeon, primary care physician, strength and conditioning coach, chiropractor, massage therapist. This is really trying to find ways to have a holistic approach towards managing the needs and concerns of a student athlete or a patient. And all of those cross collaborations really creates an environment where all of the needs of that individual can get met, because there are some physical needs, obviously, from an injury. There are mental needs, there are nutritional needs, et cetera.
So you're working from a really interdisciplinary perspective. When a student athlete has an injury, what you also said, I want to come back to something you said a minute ago, Mary, you may have a thought about this too, is getting an athlete back to baseline is part of your role too, rehab, in other words. How do you begin to assess when an athlete's ready to return to play?
Yeah, it's
tough issue, I bet.
The word interdisciplinary, where Nathan was talking about working with different healthcare professionals.
Yeah.
Right. Us working as the education side and the clinical side is very important as well. And so when you're talking about rehabilitation, you know, that is part of our curriculum, but you have to really know the mechanics of the injury. You have to know what caused the injury. Was it overuse? Was it acute? Was it a microtrauma or a macrotrauma? And so learning about what caused the injury and then knowing the body really well, knowing the body in regards to, well, if I put this joint in a loose pack position or an open pack position, how can I help facilitate that healing? Right? Because like Nathan mentioned, if you do nothing, well, that ankle isn't going to get stronger. It isn't going to necessarily. So it's really understanding the healing process at the physiological level, which we do, and then it's understanding how to implement, right, the load or to reset the injury and then to load it appropriately when it's ready to adapt to those loads. And that is part of our curriculum, but that's a really big part of that, though, is knowing how the body works and working with clinicians and for our students to be able to see athletic trainers working is you learn by doing, right?
And it seems like we've come a long way as a society, too, where maybe when I was a youth, there was a tremendous push to get athletes back to playing, maybe before they were ready. But now it seems like you've got a lot of control over that. The sports medicine professionals have more control over those decisions.
Yeah, it's kind of to piggyback on what Mary was saying is that, you know, evaluating all of that is really cutting edge now. I mean, we have tools to manage load. We have tools. And so we're really putting objective data towards that, whether it be acceleration, deceleration, whether it be the distance that someone runs, the speed that someone runs. And we don't have to guess anymore. I think, you know, when I was a younger athletic trainer, it was kind of the eye test that, oh, they know they're not limping, they're not in pain.
Yeah.
But now
it's more database.
It's database and strength levels. It's force plate initiatives where we're actually putting people through functional assessments that actually say they are back to baseline. And part of our process here at Towson University, too, with our student athletes is to have them go through, when they come through as a freshman, they go through a physical. And part of that physical is not just general medical and orthopedic, but it's performance baseline testing. And we do that from mental training to their nutrition intake to their ability to move, how well they move, their flexibility, their strength. And all of that gets collaborated holistically and multidisciplinary to drive the decisions we make when they do have an injury.
Yeah. Let's segue for a little bit because you all work a lot in your practices with highly trained competitive athletes at the Division I intercollegiate level. But I'm told that there are more than 3.5 million children every year under the age of 14 who receive medical treatment for sports injuries. So let's talk a little bit about youth sports and what parents should know, what youth coaches should know, and not just how we identify and treat sport injuries in youth, but how can we go about preventing them? What are some of your thoughts about
that is a question that has many, many layers.
Yeah.
Because you're right, like youth sport has really, especially in this area, right? There are, every time you turn around, there are multiple fields, there are kids playing on fields, there are kids playing multiple different sports.
And everywhere you look.
Everywhere you look. And so it really is trying to find that balance. And that's hard sometimes because, you know, there's this, you know, this young athlete is doing this and this young athlete is doing that. So it's really trying to figure out what's the right load for your young developing athlete. A very general rule of thumb is you can use that the age they are is the amount of hours they can compete in per week.
Huh.
So,
that's,
you know, a 10-year-old,
So a 10-year-old should really be competing no more than 10 hours a week.
10 hours of organized sport.
Uh-huh.
Certainly we want them out running and playing and jumping and doing things that they should be doing on a playground that aren't organized and structured.
Right.
But that, I, you know, I try to use that when folks do ask me, well, how much should my kid be doing? And then you have to listen, you know, as they're going through a growth spurt. And we know that as parents, that when the kids start eating a lot or sleeping a little bit more, that there's probably a growth spurt occurring there. And when that's happening, if you load a body that is changing, that may make them a little bit more susceptible to injury. We also know that, and we're looking through some things, and this is not reported data yet, but something that we're working on with colleagues that I'm working with is that you really see that a young athlete or a less mature athlete, because we know chronological age and biological age are not necessarily the same.
Yeah, she's playing athletics. That's
not every 13-year-old looks the
same. That's right. That's a good point.
And so what
development is a continuum.
It is a continuum, and you really have to assess that, well, not every 15-year-old should now be lifting weights. Nope. Where is that 15-year-old in their biological age? And so what we really know is that movement, they have to be able to move well before we allowed to load that individual.
Yeah, yeah.
So working on fundamentals and movement is really important to decreasing, you would assume, to decrease the amount of injury that happens in a person.
And it would seem as if that youth injuries during that youth period are so important for the future. Dr. James Andrews, the noted orthopedic surgeon, recently was quoted as saying, youth sport injuries are not just about sprains and strains, but they have lifelong consequences. And that's a pretty significant thing to be said by an orthopedic surgeon of his renown.
We see that. We see that fallout to that point from Dr. Andrews in what we when we do physicals on our collegiate athletes. And I do think that, you know, to Mary's point, you know, she brought up the way I would say that is the mobility is really important before stability, you know, and you don't want to load somebody who doesn't really move well because that creates compensation patterns, it creates breakdown, it creates imbalances, and those are the things that lead to injury. And what we know from the data is says that anyone who does have an injury, the number one thing that's going to cause a re-injury is that injury. So if you did have a knee sprain as a high school or a youth athlete, you're probably more likely to have an injury to that knee as a collegiate athlete. And so when I talk to parents a lot, it's I think where we've kind of gone rogue in our sport culture is that we just – everybody's going to make the professional leagues. And we early specialization has led to repetitive training and not this multidisciplinary sports. I mean, I was a 3-4 sport athlete as a high school kid, but kids today are specializing in lacrosse or specializing in baseball pitching or specializing in football, and they run with that. And that over time has led to some difficult, you know, injury consequences.
Yeah, and there's some notable groups that have been talking about that. The American Academy of Pediatrics, for example, recently said that half of all youth sports injuries are due to overuse. Mm-hmm. To overuse, that means that they're probably preventable.
Right. And it's overuse of very similar motions, right?
If you're repetitive playing, motions.
Yes, exactly. If you're playing many different things and you're doing different and you allow a season to be a season. I love that idea is that in the fall we play one sport, in the winter we play a different sport, and that fall season doesn't then merge into your winter season, can kind of keep going into the spring. We stop and we play something different, so we don't have that repetitive.
And the competitive nature of youth sports has become really hyper-competitive for some kids.
Yes.
Right, hyper-competitive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's because they're tracing the dream. You know, they're all tracing the dream that we all maybe had at one time.
Are there things about the youth period that make youth athletes more vulnerable to injury? We talked a little bit about overuse. Some of it may be coaching. Some of it may be idiosyncratic to the person. What are some of those factors?
Well, I think as children go through growth spurts, right, you know, where the bones grow, the muscles then have to stretch to accommodate that growth in the bones. And so tendon injuries or, you know, you'll hear of like an Osgood-Schlatter's at the knee where the quadriceps tendons are pulling, or you'll have a similar type of injury at the ankle. And so those injuries are due to growth spurts. And it's hard to know when a kid is actually growing, but you have to then listen. Hey, I'm a little achy or I'm a little bit more sore. Well, then maybe we just decrease the volume a little bit while they're growing, while they're a little sore. And that could ultimately really decrease, yes, a tendonitis or a tendinopathy, but also, gosh, you wouldn't want it to go as far as to be pulling on that bone so hard that you have, you know, a real injury that now needs 3 to 4 weeks of pure rest to allow that bone to then heal.
Right. Yeah, let me pick up on that theme for a second. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, says that injury prevention starts with education, and that that education should be for parents, coaches, but also for youth athletes. So with that in mind, what are some of the most effective injury prevention strategies that you might be able to talk about and help parents to put into place with their kids, particularly as you move into the fall sports season?
Yeah, I think we're really fortunate that where, you know, there are programs that are designed, you know, jump landing programs or ACL preventative programs. Now, that isn't necessarily, those are very specific, right? But ultimately, it comes back to where Nathan has used the word mobility and I've used the word movement. It really comes down to, can the child move? And so if they can't, it's teaching the children the fundamentals. So, you know, allowing coaches to, you know, recognize that sidestepping and backpedaling and karaoke stepping and high knees are all where we need to start with these young athletes before we load and start going to very, very sports specific skills. And so trying to prevent injuries is there's many different types of programs. I can't necessarily speak to just one that says, hey, this is going to solve your problem and not allow you to get injured or injure your knee. But it is teaching parents that the variety and listening to the body as it grows and develops is really important to preventing. And then finding if there is a weakness or a movement competency that needs help is finding the appropriate coach or finding the appropriate person to help that individual move through that movement pattern.
You know, your professional association, the National Athletic Trainers Association, wrote the best injury is the one that never happens. That prevention is always better than treatment, as you're saying. But also the American Academy of Pediatrics recently said that proper warm-ups, adequate rest, and cross-training are more effective than any brace or bandage. Talk a little bit about those kinds of things. What is a proper warm-up, a proper cool-down? What should young athletes think about doing in order to be preventive injury from that perspective?
I think the greatest part about teaching athletes about a proper warm-up is we can kind of tackle two obstacles at once. We can prepare the body for physical activity, but we can start working on some of those foundational movements. So we don't want, if someone's going to go out and move and run and cut, we don't want them just standing still and touching their toes, right? We want those muscles moving while they warm up in a controlled environment. So a dynamic warm-up where we, you know, we walk and touch our toes and then we walk and do a butt kick and then we do some light jogging. But through that, we can be teaching them how to functionally or how to properly do a lunge. We can be teaching them how to properly, do a back pedal. And so we can be really looking at some of those foundational movements while we're warming up the body. So that's a great way to do that, is to introduce motion in a controlled manner and to build on that before they then go out and compete in that athletic competition or that athletic sport.
And I would agree. I mean, it's really important to know that the movement is fundamental and it's neurologically wired. I mean, has anybody ever seen a 2-year-old squat on their, you know, they squat down and they pick up their toys and they have no problem doing that. But if you ask a 16-year-old to do that, they struggle. And so you can see over time how that happens. So in those dynamic warm-ups, I mean, you know, that's really important in the beginning phase of training. And the warm-up piece also is about stabilization and activation of those muscles they're going to be using most frequently. And then they go through a progressive, you know, intensity load through their workout per se, and then recovery on the back end, which maybe that is looking at the deficit that they might have, lengthening a muscle, maybe more static. And then I would like to say, just like a multidisciplinary, is putting in the calories back in and the hydration back in, which also has injury prevention. So eating and sleeping are probably the two things that are most important to injury prevention, is making sure they have adequate sleep, adequate rest, their mind is clear, not foggy, and that they are taking in adequate calories, which we see a huge issue with, even at the collegiate levels.
And hydration, as you mentioned. Hydration is really important. Speaking of hydration, we're here at the end of the summer period that many youth teams are beginning to work up again. We hear a lot about heat-related injuries. Talk a little bit about preventing heat-related injuries, but also what are some of the signs, red flags, that coaches, parents, and kids who are playing youth sports ought to look for during this very a difficult time of early season practices during the heat.
Yes, there have been tremendous advancements in the education of everyone in regards to heat. Obviously, the days are getting a little bit warmer. We notice that. And so really allowing folks to understand what heat looks like and how a heat, when you've been in the heat too long, what that looks like. As athletic trainers, we are trained to look for a couple things, but really looking for, you know, that CNS dysfunction, and then also looking at their core temperature. Now, we recognize that not everyone can assess someone's core temperature, how we are trained to do that. But those are two ways for us to know immediately if someone really needs immediate care and help to lower their body temperature. But things that we can do to teach youth sports is, you know, more frequent water breaks to get out of the heat when they are able to. Cold towels to continue to try and bring the body temperature down a little bit in between sessions will help folks kind of accommodate or acclimate to that environment. Now, I do bring up a really important word, which is acclimate, meaning that you have to get used to the environment you're going to play in, and that's really important.
Interesting.
And with Nathan, with some of our fall sports starting, there are very specific protocols about how long it takes to acclimate and how long you should be in that environment before you then put on a helmet, before you put on pads. And people really need to know that if it's been cool and all of a sudden it's really warm, your body is not going to adapt as quickly as it should because you're not used to it.
So there's some reason that high school football players aren't in pads for the first week or two of practice. There's some rationale for that.
Yes, correct. I mean, the NCAA has legislated collegiate football and acclimatization up to 7 days, required, you know, progression of adding pads and rest days. You know, and we've even taken an extra step here at Towson University where we look at, you know, athletes and what their sweat rates are, how much fluid they're putting out, how much electrolyte they're losing.
Very data-based.
Yeah, and we're able to then educate the student-athlete on what to put back in, because the number one thing that drives heat illness is actually the environment and the intensity of the exercise. So if it is a hot and humid day, humid meaning, right, more moisture in the air, your body is not going to sweat as well. You're not going to dissipate heat as well. And then if that intensity of exercise is at a very high level, those are potential catastrophic type situations. So we monitor that on a daily basis. We look at what the temperature and the humidity, and we talk through our coaching plan on what the practice is going to look like. And if we have to modify that, we do. I mean, Mary brought up water breaks, obviously, and rest periods, you know, in and out of the heat. You know, we have lots of ability as our athletic training staff on the field to manage those. But from a youth sport perspective, it's really just, again, listening and watching.
So heat-related illnesses are nothing to you really need to take these things seriously. It's a very serious matter.
Yeah, very serious. Illness.
You know, in the old days, coaches would say, work harder and then you can get a break. But those days, I think, are pretty much gone, that we've come to understand that heat-related illnesses can be catastrophic.
Yes.
We need to pay attention to it. Are there some, before we leave the topic of heat-related illness, are there some, you mentioned lightheadedness. Talk again about some of the specific signs and symptoms, just to repeat them, that coaches and parents sort of look for if there's a potential for heat-related illness.
Well, first of all, they could start cramping at a very low level, your muscle cramps in the calf or quads or sometimes in the abdomen.
And we see that in professional sports.
Yeah. And a lot of that could be for two reasons. One, it could be electrolyte depletion, or actually it could be over-drinking. A lot of people don't understand that actually drinking too much water can also be catastrophic. So it's important to follow guidelines of, you know, taking in, you know, 7 to 10 ounces of fluid every 15 minutes. I mean, you don't need a ton. I think a lot of times in the heat, people want to guzzle fluid, but you don't really need to do that. but you need to make sure you understand how much weight you're losing. Other signs are going to be, you know, dizziness, nausea. Sometimes the skin will get red and flush, you know. You might feel overheated. The red flag, like Mary said, is any type of cognitive decline. When a student athlete starts feeling dizzy, lightheaded, and they don't remember things, or their body starts to, you know, act in a way that is uncharacteristic of that person's personality, those are major red flags that we need to intervene.
Important warning signs for parents to understand.
And I'd like to add one thing. I think a lot of folks will be like, oh, they'll stop sweating. And that's when I worry. And it's like, that's really hard to determine, because if you think about yourself, you're sweating and then you might be putting a wet towel or you might be pouring water on you. That's a really hard criteria to go against. So it really comes down to, is this person acting differently? Have they been working out? Is it a humid environment? We need to really assess
and
that.
And what's going to drive that? And this is real. There's a study that was done with NHL hockey players. And what really drives that symptom, those symptoms, is core temperature. There's been studies that have shown that NHL ice hockey players have core temperatures of 104 degrees on the ice in their intensity of exercise and be asymptomatic. However, when your body, you know, cannot process that core temperature. Most people would think if you have a 104 temperature, you're sick. You don't feel good.
Sure.
But as exercise intensity with high metabolic process and muscle mass goes up, temperature is going to rise. Whenever the body gets to the point where it says, okay, I'm at a level that, you know, I don't really like, and all of a sudden it is not able to handle it and it shoots up even higher, you're going to start to get that cognitive decline. You're going to get that dizziness, lightheadedness. And so the layperson might not have the ability to understand what a temperature is, because it is core temperature, like Mary said. You can't use an oral thermometer to measure that. That is a 2 to 3 degree difference. You could be way off the mark, and between 106 and 104 could be life-threatening. So it's really just important to listen and understand that if you are in the heat, you need to be proactive in taking some precautions before you start those activities and having a plan.
And I would love to just highlight on, we've highlighted what to look for, but what becomes so important, especially for parents and youth sports, is what do you do next? Because you really, truly can help these people. And if it is a true heat emergency, a heat stroke, cooling that individual is going to be so important. Getting them out of the sun, getting them soaked in water. If there is a tarp or something, you can get them in water and sitting in cold ice water. You 100% will be able to help that person. And so, you know, there's not many lacrosse tournaments, soccer tournaments, youth football camps out there where people don't have coolers and water. And so it is possible to cool that person. And that is so very important for people to understand.
Well, let me ask you one more thing, and we'll... time is running out on this, but let me ask you this: if you could give one piece of advice to a youth sport coach or a youth sport parent or a youth athlete that would be helpful to them in both maximizing their performance but also being preventive of injury, what advice might you give?
Try many things, challenge your body to move in many different ways, and listen to your body.
It's funny you said that, Mary, because I was going to say listen to your body. And I think seek out education, right? Seek out professionals, you know, that know how they can help you, you know, if you need information. I think gathering that knowledge from professionals who work in the business, and it could be medical doctors, it could be athletic trainers, it could be physical therapists. But, you know, if you have access to an athletic trainer, I mean, we'll be glad to give you some information on how you can make yourself successful.
Well, that's great. I really thank you for joining me. The advice that you've given and the information you provided, I think, will be enormously helpful to youth sport coaches, to parents, to athletes at every level. And I want to just also say before we conclude that I know firsthand the importance of athletic training and athletic trainers. But both my sons, as you know, were both college athletes. One of my sons had two knee injuries over the course of his playing career, and I think his health and wellness as an adult is absolutely related to the care and treatment and the rehab and the prevention that he was provided by your colleagues. So thank you for the work that you do, and thank you for being here with me today. Joined by Nathan Wilder and Mary Madeline, two esteemed athletic trainers here at Towson University. Mary, an athletic training educator. Nathan, our director of sports medicine or head athletic trainer for TU's varsity teams. Thank you for being here. And thank you for joining us for On the Mark. We look forward to seeing you and having you have an opportunity to hear from us in our next episode. Again, On the Mark is a regular series of podcasts that we hold here at Towson University. I'm Mark Ginsberg, president of TU. Thank you both for joining us, and thank you for listening. Thank you for listening to On the Mark. If you like what you've heard, please give us a follow or leave a review. It helps to ensure that we can keep bringing you more candid conversations about the consequential work of higher education. If you have feedback about our podcast, I'd welcome hearing from you. Please feel free to send me a message at onthemark@towson.edu.
Founded in 1866, Towson University is a top-ranked, comprehensive public research university, recognized as Maryland's number one public institution by the Wall Street Journal. As Greater Baltimore's largest university, TU proudly serves as an engine of opportunity for nearly 20,000 students, the state of Maryland and beyond. Explore more than 190 top-ranked undergraduate and graduate degree programs and make our momentum yours at towson.edu.